Državni izpitni center. Splošna matura 2024. Lepo pozdravljeni. Pričenja se reševanje izpitne pole slušnega razumevanja angleščine. Izpitna pola je sestavljena iz dveh delov, dela A in dela B. Vsak del vsebuje govorjeno izhodiščno besedilo in nalogo, ki se nanj nanaša. Najprej boste nalogo prebrali in jo nato med poslušanjem besedila sproti reševali. Vsako besedilo boste poslušali po dvakrat. Začetek in konec besedila bo označeval takle zvočni znak. Rešitve pišite z nalivnim peresom ali s kemičnim svinčnikom v izpitno polo v zato predvideni prostor znotraj okvirja. Pišite čitljivo in skladno s pravopisnimi pravili. Če se zmotite, napisano prečrtajte in rešitev zapišite na novo. Nečitljivi zapisi in nejasni popravki bodo ocenjeni z nič točkami. Zaupajte vase in v svoje zmožnosti. Želimo vam veliko uspeha. Poslušajte pozorno. Odprite izpitno polo.
Section A. You'll hear a recording featuring Bono, the lead vocalist of the rock band U2. You'll hear it twice. Now read the task.
My castaway this week was born Paul Hewson, but thanks to a nickname from a school friend, he's one of a handful of global stars known by a single name, Bono. He achieved that stardom decades ago with a few pals from school. They've sold over 170 million albums, won 22 Grammys, more than any other band. But as it turns out, this wasn't all his life was destined to encompass. Just as his creative dreams came true, he found another job. As an activist, his commitment to the Drop the Debt campaign saw him woo presidents and slip a pair of sunglasses to the Pope, eventually leading to the cancellation of many billions of dollars owed by 35 of the world's poorest countries. He says, "When whoever said the job of the artist is to describe the problem, not to solve it, I wasn't paying attention. I want to be with the people who actually want to follow through and actually make things better." Bono, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Well, thank you. Very, very happy to be here. Wouldn't want to be anywhere else.
You were born Paul Hewson, Dublin, 1960. Your mum, Iris, was Protestant and your father, Bob, was Catholic. Obviously, sectarianism was a huge issue in Ireland at the time. Did your parents' differing backgrounds cause problems for them?
I think my father's family didn't turn up at the wedding and there were some issues. Mm-hmm. My father was very, very elegant about all this. And he used to drive us to St. Canice's Church of Ireland Church because he felt that my mother should have the choice in what religion we grew up in. So we went to this little Church of Ireland Church and then he would drive to St. Canice's, the Catholic Church. It was like 100 yards
away. So same, same, two different
churches. I mean, just so mad. Mm-hmm. You know, say you get just enough religion to inoculate you against it. I didn't. They spared me. Both of them, from any doctrinal stuff.
So what about music when you were young? Were you musical as a little boy?
I had in my head melodies from a very early age and I just couldn't quite get them out. And then there's a funny bit. I went to, with my mother, Iris, to St. Patrick's Cathedral School to see if I could get in. And they had a choir And the headmaster said, now, you know, we've got a choir here that, you know, that's some renown. And I don't know if you'd be interested in being part of that. And I'm sort of shaking, you know, I'm like, I sort of don't know where to turn. And my mother goes, no, he's not at all interested in any of that. And of course, it's not because she was trying to help me out, because she sees me being, you know,
overwhelmed,
you know, just a little, you know, not able to fess up to this. And she just was a very practical woman. She was like, nah, you know, and we don't do that kind of thing.
You mentioned, Bono, that you grew up in a house of men, and in your childhood, there was a before and there was an after. And the after came when you were 14. Your mother, Iris, died suddenly. She suffered a brain aneurysm at her own father's funeral. You say you don't have many memories of her, but when you think of her now, I wonder what comes to mind first. How do you picture her?
Laughing a lot. The mischief was upon her. One of the neighbours had told her, that boy, he needs to be disciplined with a cane. And my mother was like, a cane? And she was chasing me down the garden, and I was like terrified. And I looked back and I just saw her laughing. You know, she just couldn't take that seriously. I wrote a song, Iris, on song.
Now you will hear the recording again.
My castaway this week was born Paul Hewson, but thanks to a nickname from a school friend, he's one of a handful of global stars known by a single name, Bono. He achieved that stardom decades ago with a few pals from school. They've sold over 170 million albums, won 22 Grammys, more than any other band. But as it turns out, this wasn't all his life was destined to encompass. Just as his creative dreams came true, he found another job. As an activist, his commitment to the Drop the Debt campaign saw him woo presidents and slip a pair of sunglasses to the Pope, eventually leading to the cancellation of many billions of dollars owed by 35 of the world's poorest countries. He says, when whoever said the job of the artist is to describe the problem, not to solve it, I wasn't paying attention. I want to be with the people who actually want to follow through and actually make things better. Bono, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Well, thank you. Very, very happy to be here. Wouldn't want to be anywhere else.
You were born Paul Hewson, Dublin, 1960. Your mum, Iris, was Protestant and your father, Bob, was Catholic. Obviously, sectarianism was a huge issue in Ireland at the time. Did your parents' differing backgrounds cause problems for them?
I think my father's family didn't turn up at the wedding and there were some issues. Mm-hmm. My father was very, very elegant about all this. And he used to drive us to St. Canice's Church of Ireland Church because he felt that my mother should have the choice in what religion we grew up in. So we went to this little Church of Ireland Church, and then he would drive to St. Canice's, the Catholic Church. It was like 100 yards
away.
So same,
two different churches. I mean,
just so mad. Mm-hmm. You know, say you get just enough religion to inoculate you against it. I didn't. They spared me. Both of them, from any doctrinal stuff.
So what about music when you were young? Were you musical as a little boy?
I had in my head melodies from a very early age, and I just couldn't quite get them out. And then there's a funny bit. I went to, with my mother, Iris, to St. Patrick's Cathedral School to see if I could get in. And they had a choir. And the headmaster said, now, you know, we've got a choir here that, you know, that's some renown. And I don't know if you'd be interested in being part of that. And I'm sort of shaking, you know, I'm like, I sort of don't know where to turn. And my mother goes, no, he's not at all interested in any of that. And of course, it's not because she was trying to help me out, because she sees me being, you know,
overwhelmed,
you know, just a little, you know, not able to fess up to this. And she just was a very practical woman. She was like, nah, you know, and we don't do that kind of thing.
You mentioned, Bono, that you grew up in a house of men, and in your childhood, there was a before and there was an after. And the after came when you were 14. Your mother, Iris, died suddenly. She suffered a brain aneurysm at her own father's funeral. You say you don't have many memories of her, but when you think of her now, I wonder what comes to mind first. How do you picture her?
Laughing a lot. The mischief was upon her. One of the neighbours had told her, that boy, he needs to be disciplined with a cane. And my mother was like, a cane? And she was chasing me down the garden, and I was like terrified. And I looked back and I just saw her laughing. You know, she just couldn't take that seriously. I wrote a song, Iris, on song.
This is the end of Section A. Section B. You'll hear a recording about Lindsay Fitzharris's book, The Face Maker, in which she writes about Harold Gillis, the father of modern plastic surgery. You'll hear it twice. Now read the task.
Lindsay Fitzharris is the author of a new book on Gillis called The Face Maker. Rhiannon Davis spoke to her about his incredible career and the men whose lives he changed.
So, Lindsay, why did you decide to write this book?
I guess the short of it is I knew it was going to be a really good story. So I have a PhD in the history of science and medicine from Oxford University, but these days I don't really call myself a historian as much as a storyteller. And my first book, The Butchering Art, which is about the Victorian surgeon Joseph Lister, who's known today as the father of antiseptic surgery, is really different from what The Face Maker is. And I think a lot of my existing readers will be surprised that I decided to write this war tale about military medicine during the First World War. And actually, I was quite surprised by that as well. I went into this book knowing virtually nothing about facial reconstruction, military medicine, which is probably why it took me 5 years to research and write in the end, because I was starting from zero. But I had come across Gillis and his patients in academic works, and I just knew that there was a good story there and that it was a story that should be told in a much bigger way. Because a lot of these disfigured soldiers during the First World War were hidden from the public. I talk about in The Face Maker that they were forced to sit on brightly painted blue benches, for instance, so that the public knew not to look at them. So I really want their stories to be told. And I hope in the end, if you pick up The Face Maker and you read it, you feel that I've done their stories justice.
It seems like shame is really tied into facial disfigurements, and particularly in connection to syphilis. Could you talk a bit about that?
A lot of the reason why disfigurement is associated with shame is because of its association with disease. So syphilis, the emergence of syphilis in earlier periods led to disfigurement of the face. The nose would cave in. It was something called saddle nose. And so people associated syphilis with a moral failing. The other thing was that sometimes someone would be purposely disfigured as a form of punishment. And this all got ingrained in our culture. And so that stigma really continues even to today. If you look at Hollywood movies, a lot of villains are disfigured. And that's a really lazy trope, you know, to say that the person is evil or has some kind of moral failing. I could rattle off so many, you know, the Joker, the Phantom of the Opera, Bane, even in Batman. There's so many, and you can go on and on. And I think that's a real problem in Hollywood. So that idea is still well and alive today in 2022, unfortunately.
So let's go back then to the First World War. What was it about this conflict that made facial injuries so prevalent?
Well, the nature of trench warfare led to high rates of facial injuries, as you said. Men were maimed, they were gassed, they were kicked in the face by horses in some cases. In fact, before the war was over, I think it was something like 280,000 men from France, Britain, and Germany alone would suffer some form of facial trauma. And the medical challenges were immense at this time. This is before antibiotics. And this was a time when losing a limb made you a hero, but losing a face made you a monster to a society that was largely intolerant to facial differences. Whereas a prosthetic limb doesn't necessarily need to look like the arm or leg it's replacing, a face is an entirely different matter.
Now you will hear the recording again.
Lindsay Fitzharris is the author of a new book on Gillies called The Facemaker. Rhiannon Davis spoke to her about his incredible career and the men whose lives he changed.
So, Lindsay, why did you decide to write this book?
I guess the short of it is I knew it was going to be a really good story. So I have a PhD in the history of science and medicine from Oxford University, but these days I don't really call myself a historian as much as a storyteller. And my first book, The Butchering Art, which is about the Victorian surgeon Joseph Lister, who's known today as the father of antiseptic surgery, is really different from what The Facemaker is. And I think a lot of my existing readers will be surprised that I decided to write this war tale about military medicine during the First World War. And actually, I was quite surprised by that as well. I went into this book knowing virtually nothing about facial reconstruction, military medicine, which is probably why it took me 5 years to research and write in the end, because I was starting from zero. But I had come across Gillies and his patients in academic works, and I just knew that there was a good story there and that it was a story that should be told in a much bigger way. Because a lot of these disfigured soldiers during the First World War were hidden from the public. I talk about in The Facemaker that they were forced to sit on brightly painted blue benches, for instance, so that the public knew not to look at them. So I really want their stories to be told. And I hope in the end, if you pick up The Facemaker and you read it, you feel that I've done their stories justice.
It seems like shame is really tied into facial disfigurements, and particularly in connection to syphilis. Could you talk a bit about that?
A lot of the reason why disfigurement is associated with shame is because of its association with disease. So syphilis, the emergence of syphilis in earlier periods led to disfigurement of the face. The nose would cave in. It was something called saddle nose. And so people associated syphilis with a moral failing. The other thing was that sometimes someone would be purposely disfigured as a form of punishment. And this all got ingrained in our culture. And so that stigma really continues even to today. If you look at Hollywood movies, a lot of villains are disfigured. And that's a really lazy trope, you know, to say that the person is evil or has some kind of moral failing. I could rattle off so many, you know, the Joker, the Phantom of the Opera, Bane, even in Batman. There's so many, and you can go on and on. And I think that's a real problem in Hollywood. So that idea is still well and alive today in 2022, unfortunately.
So let's go back then to the First World War. What was it about this conflict that made facial injuries so prevalent?
Well, the nature of trench warfare led to high rates of facial injuries, as you said. Men were maimed, they were gassed, they were kicked in the face by horses in some cases. In fact, before the war was over, I think it was something like 280,000 men from France, Britain, and Germany alone would suffer some form of facial trauma. And the medical challenges were immense at this time. This is before antibiotics. And this was a time when losing a limb made you a hero, but losing a face made you a monster to a society that was largely intolerant to facial differences. Whereas a prosthetic limb doesn't necessarily need to look like the arm or leg it's replacing, a face is an entirely different matter.
This is the end of Section B.
Končuje se slušno preverjanje angleščine. Nehajte pisati, zaprite izpitno polo in jo položite na rob mize. Nasvidenje in srečno!